do
Blog
it.
Talk Radio.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, 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 yeah. The Empowerment Hour is 365 days of motivation, personal empowerment, just for you. It's your main man, Marvin Rohn, and a group. Oh, yeah. Coming to you live. It's Empowerment Saturday. We got Dr. Bruce in the house. We got empowerment. We got motivation. And much, much more. Celebrate. Come on, join us, y'all. There's no better love than for celebrating. Brothers and sisters, there is no better love, no greater love than for self and kind, and that's what the African American Empowerment Association is all about. And that is what Empowerment Saturday is all about. It's African American Empowerment on this Saturday and every Saturday, 365 Saturdays or 52 Saturdays out the year, whatever it is, 52 weeks in a year. So guess what you're going to get? You're going to get that and much, much more. We're working on ourselves, and we have to do the work of doing that. We're going to have to get to a place where we understand all that we've gone through and what that condition has done to us. And then we have to double back to organize ourselves. So let's get into the tenets of the NAAEA. It's really simple. There are five pillars, five tenets to this process. This is what we need in terms of collaboration and communication and simple effort. We need a political agenda in this country as African Americans. We are the only group that was brought to this country by force. We are the only group that exists in this country that had laws placed against us. We are the only group who has gone through chattel slavery in this country. We are the only group that has faced forced segregation. We're the only group that has faced mass incarceration. We're the only group that has been marginalized from head to toe. We're the only group that the established system is against. White supremacy does what it does, but it does what it does as it counteracts who we are. And we got to get that, right? So how do we organize? Political agenda, that's the P. I'm spelling peace. We have to have a political agenda that really have us to look at the politics in this country, the democracy that's cloaked in capitalism and vice versa, okay? You have to understand how politics can work for you, because what we need is institutions that redefine who we are as we begin to work collectively together. How do we do that? The E, economics. We have to have an economic platform, economic development, economic understanding of the capitalistic system at every turn and how it works. You, my friends, whether you're listening online or whether you're on the line right now, you have to understand the economic system of the American enterprise. It's called capitalism. I'm not saying become a capitalist. I'm saying you have to understand the system and teach it to your children. It should be in every community center. It should be in every African-American-based church, and it should be ingrained in us that we understand the system that we've been forced to function in. Then there's the A. You have to understand athletics, health, wellness, fitness, and nutrition, along with mental health and emotional health and wellness. You got to do it. We have to plug in to a place where we understand how important the health is of our people. We lead the world in health disparities. We do. If somebody wanted to refute that, go right ahead. But our people are not well mentally, physically, emotionally, socially, culturally. We're not. All you have to do is do the engagements, right? Just look at us for what we do. Now, we want to pretend that we're healthy because we can drive a new car, or we can pretend that we're healthy because we put on new clothes. But the body, the functioning of the body, you need to work out. You need to have a fitness plan and a fitness agenda. And you really need to take care of your mental, physical, and emotional health. You do, right? Get the help that you need physically, mentally, emotionally, socially, and culturally. Next is culture. relevant cultural programs like this one and many, many more. Now, the V came on and said she has a rites of passage program. We need that for adults as well, not children. I'm saying it. We need rites of passage for adults to understand how to be parents, how to be an African-American in his most positive existence. And how do we have cultural programs that refine and define who we are so we can function well and we can compete? Teach our children, chin up, chest up. And then that's the E, a comprehensive education that allow us to grow and compete positively on the world stage as we reclaim our greatness and our rightful place in the world, not just in this country. Our ancestors built it, and we have a place here. But we have the right to go wherever we want to go, and you have to assume that right for yourself and your children. Here's the Stan Mack in the moment. Be right back.
Man, Stan, the deck is packed today. I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you.
Yeah,
I just,
man,
I
we
just
got
love
the deck.
I just love it when you're able to explain the pillars of the National African American Empowerment Association. You know, when we have institutions that define our own reality, quit trying to get in to fit in, this is where it's at, and this is what we're doing.
Brother Stan is so right. We need those institutions, and we got to start thinking like that, right? Once we had a really strong foundation in the black church, I'm not saying it's gone, but it has to be, our institutions have to be relevant for us, that are impactful, that get us to a place where we're confident about who we are and what we're doing going forward. We need these institutions now, right? We need the resources behind it, right, so that we can drive some things. We need economy. We do. We need businesses, employ our people, right? We need that, and we need it desperately. Oh, we need it so, so desperately, right? We need those institutions. We're going to have to work together to do that collectively. And then the Willie Lynch and Kwanzaa segment with Brother George. Oh, yeah. Bring it. Hey, mama.
Bring it.
George.
What?
Come on, bring it. We ain't going nowhere. Brother George, how are you? Welcome to the show.
I'm doing fine, brother, and I'm glad to be back.
Welcome back, brother. Welcome
yeah,
back. What you got for us today?
Well,
go ahead, I'm sorry.
Today, well, I was going to say that the summit was really good and completely enjoyed myself. It was wonderful, man. But today,
okay, before you get in, tell the listeners about the summit so they can get some information on what you're doing, brother. At least the organization.
Well, the organization is called ARNA, the Aboriginal Republic of North America. And it was formed by Dr. Ali Muhammad and some other brothers who were working along with him. But he is the chief of our organization and or tribe. And
I like it.
And so he, you know, he always speaks, and I got a chance to speak to him personally. You know, right now we had about 8,000 in number, and so I still can get a chance to speak to him, you know, face-to-face on a one-on-one basis. But as the organization, you know, grows, he's going to be less and less accessible. And right now he told me that he'll, me and my wife are supposed to be redoing our vows. So we want to redo them in the way that the Aboriginal Moors do it. And so he said that he would come to Richmond and do that for me, you know, next year. So I look forward to that happening. You know, so, but it was, it was outstanding, man.
So all right, that's what we need. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that as we go further in the future in terms of some of the operations, right, and some of the aspects of the organization that I think could really tie in well to what we need to understand about ourselves. All right, Willie Lynch and Kwanzaa Segment, thank you for sharing, Brother George.
Yes, sir. Okay, today's Kwanzaa principle is going to be Ujamaa, cooperative economics, to build and manage our stores, shops, and other businesses to profit from them together. Now, The symbol of Ujamaa depicts two crocodiles sharing a common stomach. They illustrate the fact that we are all interdependent, and our success, in fact, our life, depends upon all of us working together for our mutual benefit. And so it's similar to addressing the issue that Brother Booker, you know, always speaks on, and that's we must unify. And he's absolutely right, you know. And it starts with black male and black female. Now, today, I'm going to read from an interesting book. It was written back in 1984, and the name of the book is Just the Willie Lynch Segment, The Endangered Black Family, Coping with the Unisexualization and Coming Extinction of the Black Race. Yet black crusaders have attacked inequities in every major social institution in American society except the family, let alone black male-female relations as such. In the area of education, we have fought for school integration and raised the alternative of community control and quality black-oriented education. In politics, we now have the right to vote and already have elected mayors, congressmen and women, state legislatures, and the like. In economics, we have the fair employment laws, black capitalism, and black left-wing efforts to replace capitalism with socialism. In aesthetics, we have excellence in music and entertainment, acting on television and black movies produced and directed by blacks, as well as Hollywood proper. And in religion, we have established our own churches and our denominations, even our own sects, and now are searching for a universal black theology. But what we've done for the black family collectively, aside from asserting the notion of its strength and tracing its elusive and ancient African roots, this is good anthropology, but it is not black reconstruction. So essentially, we've got all these different so-called gains, and they are gains, but we haven't addressed the relationship between the black male and the black female, because everything starts there. You can't have a child without a male and a female in some type of relationship. You can't have a tribe if you don't start with male and female, because everything starts with those two. So until we begin to seriously address the relationship that we have with our women and get really serious about it, it's going to be very difficult for us to come together as a people. And I think that's why the Hares were stressing the endangered black family, because if we don't get that right, it's going to be serious problems for our people in the future. So I'd like to move on from there. Maybe we can have a topical discussion, a program that's explicitly focused on that. But that's not today. So back to you, Brother Marvin.
All right. Thank you, Brother George. Great segment. Great point, right? We got to get that relationship together. Before you go, what's the first step? What do we need to do to get our men and women on the same page?
Well, we need to start talking to each other. And we need to start talking about that. How can we create a culture that we begin to talk to our young males and females and understand of how you treat people, you know, how you need to be treated and what it is that you do best, you know, as a male, what do you do best? As a female, what do you do best? And how can you think of ways to make the relationship work rather than give up on the relationship as soon as the child shows up and it's responsibility that's involved, you know. In the Aboriginal tribe of the Arna, we have what you call covenant keepers, and the male has three and the female has three. And what they're there for is when the relationship gets in trouble, you're supposed to call upon them to keep the relationship together, not to sit around and gossip to help break the relationship up. Covenant keepers are there to help your relationship survive. And I think that that's something that we need to incorporate with all of our marriages that we are involved with. And I think that's where we could start, brother.
I like it. I like it so much. Thank you, Brother George. Great job.
You're welcome.
Great job.
Thank you.
Man, I like that, brother. Does it every week. Look, if you're not reading a book, get a book, one book, any book, and begin to read it. We need to do some work. Some work needs to be done within ourselves. The brother just mentioned how we need to have cooperative economics as the Kwanzaa principle. We need, first and foremost, peace within our communities. Just look around the country at where we are. You got to see it. We need good families. And we need our children to be inside of good families. What a set, I said a set, of great parents that are guides, that are teachers, that are mentors, that are role models for our children. This is what we need. You have to recall that our families are in a state of crisis and emergency. Many of them are. If yours is an exception, great job. Keep it up. But there are lots and lots of families around this country that are African American who are suffering from dysfunction, pain, hurt, trauma, and drama. It's up to us to change that. We have to get to a point where we understand how each of us matter to the other. We're going to have to do that. We're going to have to give our children the best examples possible going forward, along with those institutions that I mentioned. You're going to have great schools that our children can go to, but they have to come from great homes that are supplied by great parents, that they are part of great families that teach, train, and develop. Right, and teach the children to understand who they are and that they're not inferior, that they matter, and that they're loved and cherished and honored. And it's just a great thing to just to be alive, right? And we got to give that to our children. And we also have to regain a greater respect for our elders, our seniors. And I'm going to close on this. We have to love each other again. Haven't we figured that out? It's going to be up to us, but we're going to have to do that together, and we're going to have to do that soon. That collective work and responsibility starts with us, with each individual, and you have to do the work of starting with yourself. Let's begin to get love back into our families, back into our communities, and back into ourselves. It's our work. It's our job. We got to do it, and we got to start today. It's African American Empowerment. We got Dr. Bruce coming up right now. Hold on tight. Oh, yeah. Dr. Bruce, your turn, baby. Come on.
Bring it. What?
Dr. Bruce, welcome to the show. How are you?
Okay, my brother. What about you?
Oh, I'm doing fine, man. Doing fine. I'm rested. I'm motivated. I'm inspired. We had a nice trip. And I do want to say, I apologize for missing you last week, but we had some things going on as we traveled back to Richmond, and we had a great stay in Myrtle Beach that we talked about, a great opportunity to spend some time with family and really collect ourselves and just have a good time before we get back on to the fall season. What do you have today, brother?
Great state. You had a great state. Where now?
Myrtle Beach, man. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina.
Okay, okay. Well, what about the Black Beach? Did you go to the Black Beach while you were down there?
What Black Beach?
Huh?
Man.
You didn't go to the Black Beach?
No, we went to North Myrtle. North.
Okay, well, you know, there's a Black Beach in South Carolina called Atlantic Beach, Brother Marvin.
Okay.
And it's between North Myrtle Beach and Myrtle Beach, and it's the, as a matter of fact, it's the only surviving Black Beach and incorporated city in the United States of America. And during the early mid-1960s, that was the only beach that Black people could go to. Atlantic Beach, South Carolina has a Black mayor, Black city council, and the whole thing. But Myrtle Beach just came along after segregation and after Jim Crow laws had been somewhat relaxed. And so Black people started going to Myrtle Beach, man. But whenever you go that way, check out Atlantic Beach, South Carolina. And to those who are tuned in, who go to beaches and the summer's just about over, choose Atlantic Beach, South Carolina to go to. And while you're there, you can go to Myrtle, too. But at least check in on the Black Beach called Atlantic Beach, South Carolina. Most people don't know about it, but many years ago, church groups and everybody would go to Atlantic Beach because there was segregation. Nobody could go to the white beaches. White people didn't want Black folk on the beach with them. And just imagine this now. Here is a group of people, meaning white Americans, who have stolen the land from the indigenous people here of color, Black folks, stolen the land from Black folk here, and then took the land that they stole and want and make decisions as to who can go and come and visit that particular piece of land or water that they have stolen. Now, isn't that something when you think about it? I mean, these people are crazy, man. You know, you're going to steal the land from other people, and then you're going to decide or make rules and regulations as to who can enjoy the land that you have stolen. It's funny when you think about it, Brother George in the background laughing. It's funny, isn't it, George?
Yes, sir, it is funny.
It is, and then you see the first, and this is not our topic today, but this is another topic for another time. But the first Black beaches in the United States, just historically, was a beach called Highland Beach in the Maryland area, and it was started by the son of Frederick Douglass in 1893. Now, a lot of people don't know this history, and I always like to have some people. Like for people to learn or get something from what I'm trying to say. But Highland Beach, started by Frederick Douglass's son and his wife, was the first. And then there was another Black beach, too, started by Black people called Carr Beach, which is also in the Maryland, D.C. area. And, of course, there's Oak Bluff up on Martha's Vineyard, where Obama used to go in the summertime, and he and Maya Angelou and his Obama's wife would go there. But these are just some of the Black beaches. But this beach property and how it was bought and developed by Black people is a very interesting topic. But that's another topic for another time. But just wanted to let you know, Brother Marvin, that you left Richmond, Virginia, and went down to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, went right past Atlantic Beach and didn't stop in on your own people and went to see white folk. But you didn't know.
I must
and
do
that's
better.
What goes
didn't
that's
know.
What that's why knowledge is very, very, very important. That's why knowledge is important. And when we don't have knowledge, that those are the kinds of things that we do, don't we?
That's true. That's why you gotta turn in and tune in to the show, brothers and sisters, so you can learn something new every week. I know from now on, when we go to Myrtle Beach, we're going down to Atlantic Beach, check on our people. You know, here in Virginia, we had to go to Buck Road Beach because we couldn't go to Virginia Beach. And so if you're in Virginia, you know, native of Virginia, many of our people had to go to Buck Road Beach down in the Hampton area instead of down at Virginia Beach as well. So it's been segregated.
And Buckhead Beach, that's the beach where they had the fence. And black folk on one side of the fence and white folk on the other side of the fence.
Right.
Buckhead Beach, right. Yeah, I've read about Buckhead. Yeah, there you go again. The thieves now, they got the land, and then they're going to put a fence up and say who can go on one side of the fence and who can't go on the other, and all kind of craziness of that. But that's the way it was at Buckhead Beach. But you're right, Brother Marvin.
Recapturing the African mind, when we get our minds back and begin to think and begin to reason and to analyze and to study, then we can know the correct decisions to make in life. And until that time, we'll go to Atlantic Beach. We'll bypass Atlantic Beach and go to Myrtle Beach and won't know anything about the Gullah Geechee beaches down in South Carolina, Gullah Geechee beaches down near Charleston,
right,
South Carolina. You see, that's some more black beaches, you know. And so anyway, the knowledge has to be exaggerated. The knowledge has to be extensive, and we have to start to learn as a people. And on last week before last, we were discussing Dr. Kwame Nkrumah in our reading of Recapturing the African Mind. We were discussing the responses of African leadership to colonial education and to the colonizers of Africa. And on page 173 in Recapturing the African Mind, Dr. Nkrumah, in his book called Class Struggle in Africa, and he talks about the fact, and I'm reading from his book, he says, under colonialism, an intelligentsia educated in Western ideology emerged and provided a link between the colonial power and the masses. It was drawn for the most part from the families of chiefs and from the moneyed, meaning people with money, from the moneyed sections of the population. And he's saying that colonialism brought up this divide and just separated people, the middle class from the lower class and the upper class, that kind of thing, and had what was called chief, where the chiefs and their families were above the other people in the population, divided people. And he began to see that as he studied colonialism. And Dr. Nkrumah also in his book, he talked about how the products of English public schools have their counterparts in the British ex-colonial territories. These are the bourgeoisie establishment figures who try to be more British than the British and who imitate the dress, manners, and even the voices of the British public school and elite. And this is also what happens in Black America when many of us go to schools, European schools, and not just European schools, but even when we go to HBCUs, oftentimes we, and I read again what Nkrumah said, he says we try to be more British than the British, or we can change that to be more white American than the white American, and imitate the dress, the manners, and even the voices of the British public schools. And that's the same thing that happened here in America. You see, when we understand African history, we will find that the same thing that happened in Africa under colonialism happened in America under the system of slavery. You see, so those two terms, slavery and colonialism, are somewhat synonymous. You see, so when we talk about colonialism in Africa, we're talking about Africa that was conquered and was taken advantage of and controlled by European people. And when we talk about slavery in America, we're talking about European people controlling, manipulating, and being totally in charge of African people in the United States. So one part of the world we call it colonialism, and another part of the world we call it slavery. And Huey P. Newton and the Black Panther Party, during this month of Black August, as we celebrate our heroes of struggle and heroes of resistance, like Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale and little Bobby Hutton and Kathleen Cleaver and some of the women also who were involved in the Black Panther Party. As we celebrate them, we have to understand that Huey Newton, he called America a colonial society. And that's what he was talking about, because he had seen and studied and read it in African history. So African leadership responded to white people taking over their country. And last week we talked about Dr. Nkrumah and how he actually received his consciousness and the knowledge that he had from studying with Dr. Youssef Ben-Yochanan and from studying with John Henry Clark in the Harlem study group that they had in Harlem, New York, when Nkrumah would leave Lincoln University in Lincoln, Pennsylvania, and go to New York City to meet with the brothers, you see. And he learned from Dr. Ben, from John Henry Clark. He learned from these people, and then that particular knowledge he got after he got his education at Lincoln University, he went back to Ghana and became the first president of independent Ghana in about 1960. So that's what we had talked about on last week with Nkrumah. And another one of our African leaders that we're going to talk about today, we're just going to deal with about one or two more, in the country of Guinea, in the country of Guinea. And to those who may not know and who might have your maps, Guinea is a country in West Africa, and it has a tremendous amount, as most African countries, a tremendous amount of natural resources. The French wanted Guinea because of its bauxite. Bauxite is very, very, very prominent in Guinea, and it's a mineral that you make aluminum from. Aluminum is made from bauxite, but Guinea has millions of acres of bauxite in that particular country. So the reason the French conquered and took control of Guinea was to get the bauxite from Guinea to build up Europe. And there's a book called How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, and talk about how the resources were taken from African countries and started the Industrial Revolution in the world, you see, which is another story, you see. And so Africa is no small figure in the world of numbers. Africa is not small at all when we look at it, but Africa has been made weak and powerless through colonialism and through corrupt leadership and various other kinds of things. But Guinea was known for its bauxite. And as a matter of fact, Guinea was the most productive of all the French West African colonies. The French had other colonies in West Africa, like Senegal. They had Senegal. They also had Togo. They had Benin. They had these countries in West Africa. But the most productive of all France's West African colonies was Guinea. And that's where Sékou Touré was born. Now, Sékou Touré, a little bit on his history, African leadership and their responses to missionary, to the missionaries in Africa. Sékou Touré went to a mission school and was an excellent and disciplined student, but he refused to learn colonial history. Now, listen to this. This is very interesting here. On page 174 of Recapturing the African Mind, Sékou Touré outrightly refused to learn colonial history, meaning the history of France. Early in his education, Touré realized that his mind was being destroyed. He went so far as to tear out pages from the French textbooks which negatively portrayed his predecessor, Samori Touré. Now, Samori Touré was an African leader and was a predecessor of Sékou Touré, and he was known, Samori Touré was known to fight against the French and to wage armed struggles against the French taking over the country of Guinea. Of course, they were unsuccessful, but it's never unsuccessful when you're in a revolution and when you at least attempt to fight, even though you never lose. You attempt to fight no matter what the circumstances. So Samori Touré, who was the predecessor of Sékou Touré, fought against the French, and Sékou Touré knew his history. He knew about Samori Touré. So Sékou Touré was determined to never learn falsified African history. There was an occasion in the school with the African boys when they were told to learn about the French teachers, and when it was
Sekou Touré's turn, he refused to repeat what he had learned about these white French teachers, and he explained that Napoleon Bonaparte was portrayed as a great hero and brilliant strategist and had conquered Europe. However, when it came to Samori Touré, Sekou Touré's predecessor, the class was taught that Samori Touré was bloodthirsty for fighting for his own country. And Sekou Touré could not understand how Napoleon Bonaparte, who killed thousands conquering Europe, could be hailed as a hero while Samori Touré would not be looked upon as a hero. White people have always tried to define for us who our heroes are and who our heroes are to be. This is why during the 60s, Malcolm was looked upon quite negatively by many black people, because white people portrayed him as being a wild-eyed, crazy radical, that he was violent, and all kinds of things that made black people not look at Malcolm, but made us to look at Martin Luther King, because Martin Luther King was what? He was nonviolent. He was able to get along and go along. But you see, they didn't want to have Malcolm in front of us as a leader, because some of us might want to try to be like Malcolm, and that's not what European people want. And this is why some people, and since we're talking about Black August, all this relates that we're talking to, this is August and coming to the end of the month of August, this is why many people are beginning to look at Black August as really being an alternative to Black History Month started by Carter G. Woodson, because Black History Month tended not to talk about the brothers like the Panther Party and the All African People's Revolutionary Party and the Nation of Islam and some of those other kinds of organizations that are considered to be radical by white America. Most of those kinds of organizations are not discussed during Black History Month, so people are beginning to highlight people like young Fred Hampton, who was killed in his bed in Chicago with not a chance to defend himself, shot while he was asleep in his apartment in Chicago. The leader of the Chicago chapter of the Black Panther Party, Fred Hampton was, who is also birthday is in Black August, this being Black August, you see. So we have to choose, as Brother Marvin always says and Brother George, we have to choose and define who our own leaders are. So Samori Touré was not considered to be a leader for the black people in Guinea to follow or to look up to or to idolize because of his tactics, you see. But we should never allow other people to choose for us who our leaders are going to be, you see. Okay, just a little information there on Sekou Touré. And one of the other people who responded responded to the missionaries in West Africa. Now, Thomas Sankara, and to those who are taking notes and who are learning, we discussed Kwame Nkrumah, first president of Ghana. We've discussed Sekou Touré, first president of the country of Guinea, also in West Africa. And now we go to another country in West Africa called Burkina Faso. Burkina Faso. We're taking a little trip now to a few of the countries in West Africa, from Ghana to Guinea and now to Burkina Faso. And I'm going to spell that because some people do like to take notes and go back and look things up. Burkina Faso. B-U-R-K-I-N-A. Burkina, again, I spell it B as in black, U as in Uhuru, R as in rap, like Rap Brown, K as in Congo, I-N-A, Burkina Faso, last word, F-A-S-O, two words. Now, Burkina Faso is a small country in West Africa. It was called Upper Volta by the French, but when Thomas Sankara became president, he got rid of the French name Upper Volta and changed it to Burkina Faso, which means land of the upright people. It means land of the upright people. And so the French conquered and colonized Burkina Faso, and Burkina Faso had a revolution, and Thomas Sankara became its president. And Thomas Sankara was a student in Madagascar. Now, Madagascar, to those who are listening and to those who are taking notes and have a map, Madagascar is that small island off the east coast of Africa, Madagascar. That's where Thomas Sankara went to military school in the early 1970s. And while he was there, he witnessed and became a part of several political activities. He became involved in protests by young medical students and workers in the capital city of Madagascar, which is called Antsirabe. And he was there at the capital city, and he saw medical students protesting and fighting for their rights. And he was exposed to many political ideas while he was there. Also, Thomas Sankara witnessed the 1972 communist-led revolution while in France, and he was also exposed to the writings of Huey P. Newton in the United States. So you see, Thomas Sankara in Madagascar, which is a French-speaking island, Thomas Sankara, who also went to school in France, and Kwame Nkrumah, who we talked about more on last week, who came to America, both these men were influenced by what black people had done in their struggles in the streets and cities in the United States of America. And this is what inspired Dr. Nkrumah in West Africa when he studied with Dr. Ben and Dr. John Henry Clark in the Harlem Study Group. And Thomas Sankara was inspired by the readings that he had in France of reading Huey P. Newton and the Black Panther Party. Now, Thomas Sankara, to those who might want to read on him later on, because he's very little known, he was killed. It's a long story. He was killed by his best friend who wanted to be the leader of the country, his best friend, Kempurore. I won't even spell it. You look up Thomas Sankara, whose name I will spell. You can look Thomas Sankara, just like it sounds. Thomas, S-A-N-K-A-R-A. Thomas, S-A-N-K-A-R-A. Thomas Sankara. He was a very young president in Africa, went to Harlem to speak at one time, and he made a speech when he was in power in response to the missionary education and missionary control in Africa. And he said to the students, where he was speaking on this particular speech that I'm going to read a small amount of, he said, "Our graduates must not serve their own interests and those of the exploiting classes, but those of the popular masses." I want to repeat that. Thomas Sankara said that graduates must not serve their own interests and those of the exploiting classes, or the people exploiting the country, but serve those of the popular masses. He says that the revolutionary education taught in the new school must imbue everyone with an ideology and personality that liberates them from learning by rote. And to get off the book for a minute, those who may not be familiar, learning by rote means just to learn what you are learning through your memory, by rote memory, old folks used to say. And Sankara was saying that we have to develop a way of learning and be liberated from learning by rote, just memorizing, as we did in many of our classes as we were going through elementary, high school, and our college-level classes. We just had to memorize and give back to the professor what the professor gave to us. Sankara is saying, no, that's not learning. Now, I'm going back to the book. He says, one of the missions of mission schools in the democratic and popular society will be to teach students to critically and positively assimilate the ideas and experiences of other peoples. He's saying you have to begin to critically think and positively assimilate the ideas and experiences of other people, not to just memorize something, Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall, Humpty Dumpty had a great fall, I pledge allegiance to the United States of America, for which is a republic, blah, 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 blah. All this rote memory stuff that we have to go through with no analysis, no synthesis, and nothing at all to relate it to. You see, he's saying that has to be out. And as I said week before last, and as I always say, when I'm talking about these things like I am today about what happened in West Africa and what Thomas Sankara was speaking on, just think about it and relate it to what's going on with us today. These are the same kinds of things that we need to do, begin to analyze and to critically think and positively assimilate ideas and begin to learn on our own. You see, when we listen to the news, critically analyze it. When we watch television, critically analyze it. Think about what's being said as opposed to just taking it all in and then just giving it back by rote or by memory. Thomas Sankara. Another thing I'd like to say about Sankara before I leave Thomas Sankara, and you can read more about him on the internet and also on YouTube if you want to see something. Well, he spoke French, but of course some of his speeches are translated into English. But Thomas Sankara, which is an interesting story about him, he was interviewed by a French reporter at one time. And the French reporter came into Sankara's office in Burkina Faso while he was president, and the reporter said, Mr. Sankara, it's very clear that when you speak, you're very intelligent and that you're well-read, but I see no books in your office. And you and I both well know, to those who are tuned in today to the National African American Empowerment Program, you know that most people in their offices have books. But this French woman who was going to interview Sankara saw no books in his office. So she wondered why. And when she asked him the question, he pushed his chair had rollers on it, pushed his mobile chair from his desk straight back and had a foot locker full of books. And he opened the foot locker and took some of the books out and showed him. He said, here are my books. My books are here in this foot locker right behind me on the floor. He says, the reason my books are not displayed is because when people come into your environment and they see what you're reading, then they know how you think. And I don't always want people to know how I think or what I'm thinking. So I keep my books concealed as I keep my thoughts concealed. I want you to think about it, brothers and sisters, to those who are tuned in. When people come into your home, when they come into your apartment, when they come into your study, when they come into your den, when they come in anywhere in your house, and they see your artwork, and they see the books, if you have any, and they see other artifacts, memorabilia, or when they see little whatnots and things on the stand here and there, it tells them something about your thinking. Something about your thinking. It reminds me of when we were growing up, you would go into most black people's homes, and what would they have? They'd have the picture with Jesus in the middle and Martin Luther King on one side, I think it was, and John F. Kennedy or somebody on the other side. Some of y'all remember those pictures, to those who are tuned in today. So when the insurance man came in, oh, he knew good and well. He had a good sale then. He knew you were going to buy something from him. Or when the man came to sell sheets and pillowcases and to sell other linen products like they used to go around through the black community, when they saw those things on your wall, they know how to deal with you. In the same way that they know how to deal with you if they come into your home and they see that picture of Huey P. Newton with his rifle and his black tam, black beret on, sitting in that wicker chair that you all have seen. They know how you're thinking. When they come into your house and they see Malcolm on the wall, when they come into your house and they see Nkrumah on the wall, you see, when they come into your house and don't see a white Jesus on the wall, then they know that they got to deal with you a little differently from somebody who's reading about Petticoat Junction and reading about other European fairy tales, you see. So I thought that was very interesting. Sankara said, I don't always want people to know what I'm thinking, so therefore you don't always see my books. Our last person we're going to talk about, which will take us to the end of this chapter and also to the end of our program for today, which is a good stop, is Maurice Bishop. Now, Maurice Bishop, to those who may not know, Maurice, M-A-U-R-I-C-E, Bishop, B-I-S-H-O-P. Maurice Bishop was the president or prime minister of Grenada. And by the way, Grenada is a small island in what are called the Lesser Antilles Islands in the Caribbean. Maurice Bishop was born in Aruba, which is a small island, but moved at an early age to Grenada. But Grenada is called the Spice Island. It's known for nutmeg, as a matter of fact. And many white people are there right now, since we were talking about the beaches earlier, laying out on the beaches year-round. The population in Grenada, about 90% black. And the United States, those who may not who have not forgotten, the United States invaded Grenada in around 1983, 1984. And Maurice Bishop was the president at that time. And Maurice Bishop took over from the president through a bloodless coup d'etat. And to those who are not familiar with that term, want to acquaint you with another term here. Maurice Bishop took control of the island of Grenada in a bloodless, no blood shed, in a bloodless coup d'etat. That coup d'etat is spelled C-O-U-P, then the letter D with a little asterisk over it, T-A-I-T, coup d'etat. Coup d'etat means, it's a French term, by the way, for the overthrow of a government. So Maurice Bishop took over his country from a man by the name of Eric Gary, who was in the hip pockets of England and America, and he took over in a coup d'etat, which means a takeover of a government. That's what coup d'etat means. But this was a bloodless coup, and Maurice Bishop became president. And to those who like to read a little bit about Maurice Bishop. And Maurice Bishop, again, brothers and sisters, to those who are tuned in, Maurice Bishop, very good student in high school, received a scholarship to study law in England. And when he went to England, and I heard him say this himself in his own speeches, he went to England, and of course, Grenada was colonized by the British. Let me make that clear, colonized by the British, going back over what we said. Guinea was colonized by the French, and Ghana, Nkrumah's country that we talked about, was colonized by the British, and Guinea was colonized by the French, and Burkina Faso, the country of Thomas Sankara, was colonized by the French. But Maurice Bishop's little island just south of us in the Caribbean, his island of Grenada, was colonized by the British. So when Bishop went to college, he went to England, and he said himself that I went to England and went to a soccer game. And when I went to the soccer game, they played the British national anthem. And he say he stood up at the soccer game for the British national anthem quicker than the British themselves. As a matter of fact, he was the white British people around looking at him. He jumped up for their national anthem quicker than the British did themselves. And he began to realize that he had been miseducated in the same way that in our schools when we grew up, we had to stand up for the Star Spangled Banner and the Old Glory and all this kind of madness, you see. But Maurice Bishop said himself that he realized how miseducated he was as he began to learn. He was more British than the British, as we talked about earlier in Dr. Nkrumah's speech that I talked about. He says we imitate them more than we imitate our own selves. And Maurice Bishop also would talk about how on the birthday of the Queen, the birthday of Queen Elizabeth, when he was a little boy growing up in Grenada, as they do in all the British colonies, on the birthday of the Queen, they have these parades, and black people had to stand out in the hot 90-degree sun and salute the Queen as the motorcade passed in his particular island. And Maurice Bishop said he'll never forget that. And after standing for hours in the sun, black people, black boys and girls in the school system saluting the Queen, and then after it's all over, you go home and they get, I mean, go back to school and they give you a little biscuit, which was supposed to have been a little gift for you honoring the Queen. You see, all this kind of madness. But this is a lot for us to study as a people. But Maurice Bishop, as I was about to say, went to school in England, and while in England, he too read the works of Huey Newton and read the works of Malcolm X and read the works of Marcus Garvey, and he received his education and went back and took over his country. And I have a speech in my book here as I begin to conclude for today in the chapter on page 187. Maurice Bishop talks about, he says, under the colonial system, the teacher, like the school, remained isolated and often alienated from the society he or she so much wanted to serve. The school and its Eurocentric core of knowledge, and again, I'm off the subject for, I mean, off the speech for a minute, brothers and sisters, want you all to think about our training and our teaching also as you listen to what Bishop said. Bishop, going back to Maurice Bishop now, Bishop says, the school and its Eurocentric core of knowledge stood out like a fortress against the people, pumping out colonial images and values. The teacher was forced to be a propagandist for the colonialist system by virtue of the curriculum he had to teach, and thus often became bitter and felt abused and exploited. And though our teachers often struggled relentlessly against this role carved out for them, and I'm off the speech for a minute. Think about it, brothers and sisters. Our teachers had to also be propagandists for white America in our classrooms when we grew up, and oftentimes they struggled, too, against the role that was carved out for them. There are stories, and Dr. Rogers talked about, I think it was, about how many, I read it somewhere, black teachers would teach what they were supposed to teach, but at the same time, when I say supposed to teach, they would teach what the system had given them to teach. But at the same time, they would have a little book under the desk that they would pull out with a little bit of black history if they could get away with it. Now, I'm back to Bishop here as I begin to end today and take some calls. And although our teachers often struggle relentlessly against this role carved out for them, the colonial grip on the economy and the education system of our country, meaning Grenada, remained, although it often faltered, through the live resistance of our people, So I'm going to close with that and give it back to Brother Marvin and let you do whatever you need to do right now, Brother Marvin. And I do want to say that I hope those of you who are listening did get something from the lecture. And just to briefly go back over, remember we talked about Kwame Nkrumah, who went to Lincoln University from Ghana, West Africa. We talked about Sékou Touré from Guinea, a country in West Africa colonized by the French. We also talked about Thomas Sankara from the country of Burkina Faso, which was colonized by the French. And we also just finished a little discussion of Maurice Bishop from the country of Grenada. And these were African leaders, African leaders in Africa, and Bishop was in Grenada, and there are many others, but these are just the ones that I use in my book as examples of how they stood up against colonial education and against the colonizers taking over their countries and taking over their minds. And in so doing, I'm trying to help us recapture our minds today. Back to you, Brother Marvin.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Bruce. Great lecture, great information. Before we move on to the question and answer, I want to kind of bring our new listeners up to speed. What is the purpose, and what was your purpose behind writing this beautiful book, Recapturing the African Mind?
Okay, good question. And before I answer my purpose for writing it, let me tell you how I was inspired. I was inspired to write this book by having traveled to Jamaica and saw that in Jamaica, black folk were singing chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, and I'm dreaming of a white Christmas in Jamaica. I want y'all to think for a minute now, to those who are tuned in, critically analyze what I'm saying here, which is very simple. Here we are or here there are people on an island in the Caribbean, 90% black and about 95%, I mean 95 degrees year-round, Jamaica, and they singing Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire and Jack Frost Nipping at Your Nose and Dreaming of a White Christmas. So I saw that, and then I began to say, well, why are these people doing this? And then I began to study and found out that they were doing what they had been taught to do by the British colonizers. And then I traveled to Zimbabwe, Southern Africa. And while in Zimbabwe, Southern Africa, as I talk about, I think, on the back of my book, in Southern Africa, I saw black children on the front page of the newspaper in Zimbabwe, a country totally black, black president controlled by black people, but these black children in a downtown store, which was on the front of the newspaper, I was in the hotel, got the morning paper at the time, then they were sitting on the knee of a white Santa Claus. Big, big mass of black folk in line, and some sitting on the knee, and others waiting to talk to a white Santa Claus in Zimbabwe. So these are the kinds of things that I began to see. And then when I went to Nigeria, I saw black people who were using Natanola and bleaching glow to lighten their skins and to look like that white image of Jesus that they saw and to look like that white colonizer who conquered them that they were trying to imitate. I began to see these things, Brother Marvin. And so this is what inspired me to do the book. And as I began to see this, in teaching a course at St. Augustine's College in Raleigh, North Carolina, I was teaching world civilization, and I noticed that whenever Caucasian people left Europe and began to conquer and colonize other nations of the earth, that they would always send in their missionaries, merchants, and the military to control the people, the three M's. And this is what inspired me to write the book. And I was inspired by that, and my purpose was to show the inconsistencies and to show up the inconsistencies and the hypocrisy of white America while teaching our people at the same time to know who they are and to understand why we're in the condition that we're in. And then when you understand why you're in the condition, then you can work to try to get your mind straight and recapture your own minds and to think for yourself.
Thank you, Dr. Bruce. It's all about education, African-American empowerment through education. Knowledge is power. Knowledge is power, brothers and sisters. Thank you, Dr. Bruce. We're going to go to the lines now, and this is how we do it. We're going to call the last four of your number if you're on the call-in line. If you want to call in and have a question or a comment or a thought for Dr. Bruce, 845-277-9250. That's 845-277-9250 for questions and comments. Oh, and if you want to get that book, Recapturing the African Mind, beautiful cover, great information, 919-956-5972. Call Dr. Bruce directly. You can meet him, get to know him. He's a great guy. 919-956-5972. Get the book. Follow us through. We're on page 173 or 174 in the book right now. All right, to the lines. Here we go. The last four of your phone number is...
Got quite a few, Brother Marvin? Got quite a few there on the line?
Yeah, we're looking good today. Quite a few.
Okay, good. That's right. So that maybe they'll keep the questions and the comments brief and so we can move on and get to them, okay?
All right. And if you don't have a comment at all, just say, hey, thanks for the lecture today. I'm calling from wherever you're calling from. You don't have to tell us your name, all of that, your address and Social Security number. You got to do all of that with this show. It's a family show. All right. We're going 5347. 5347, let me bring it in just a little bit before we get started. Here we go. 5347, you're up live. Here we go. Oh, yeah. Bring it. Question and answer.
Bring it. What?
Right. I'm sorry, y'all. I like that. I really do. 5347, you're up first on the call-in line. Question and answer. You got a question, answer, comment, thought, where you calling from? 5347. All right. Nothing wrong with listening. Let's go down to 3347. 3347. You're up next. You're live. And you're on the Empowerment Show with Dr. Bruce. Do you have a question or comment?
Not talking, huh?
3347.
3347.
All right. They're on there. I can hear you. Let's go over to 5430. 54. The last four of your number. 5430. Welcome to the show. How are you? Welcome.
The people don't want to talk to us, huh, Brother Mom? Don't even want to say.
Yeah. All right.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, hey, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm fine. This is Adrian Nita calling from Durham, North Carolina, a friend of Dr. Bridges, and I'm enjoying the teaching. And so I just listen. I'd like to make one comment. I think that recapturing the African mind for some of us is probably going to be a lifelong process because we've been so indoctrinated. Mm-hmm. But just having an awareness of is a start, you know. But then we got to dig deeper, I feel, and stop being so persuaded by things we see on TV and things we hear and take it for the face value, but dig deeper. So I'm enjoying the teaching today. Thank you.
That's a good point that you make, caller, Brother Adrian. That's a good point you're making. I was thinking about it, which I didn't say when I was discussing the book. Now, you probably remember this. You may not have picked up on it, but, you know, sometimes you remember those programs that those cowboy programs always referred to the indigenous people who they don't have them looking like they're supposed to look because they look like us, but they always referred to them as savages when they talked about the so-called Indians, and they would oftentimes some of these shows like Yancey Derringer would be taking place on a plantation in Louisiana, which when we were growing up and watching this stuff, we didn't pick up on it, did we?
We did not pick up on it. I mean, the Lone Ranger is a whole bunch of them, and so we, you know, we all were taught that they were the indigenous people were the villains, were the bad people, you know. And so
that's right.
You know, so and
I'm glad you're listening too. I hope you keep listening to Brother Marvin's show. He's on every Saturday at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Hey, Brother Adrian, I got a quick question for you before you go. You said we need to dig deeper. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, just have a willingness to look further. I mean, you know, just don't take things for face value. And I think first you have to have a desire to do it, but you got to have somebody to prick the brain and say, you know what, I've been tricked all these years. I don't know what it takes for these individuals, you know. But, you know, and I had a brother talk to me the other day. He called me and said, you know, man, he said, white people have done a number on us. I said, yeah, it's about time we realize that. You know, and but it's in all faith. I mean, you could, everything. I mean, some things we watch on TV. It's okay to watch TV, but don't just take it for face value. You know,
right?
I mean, exploiting. I mean, if you watch a football game, you know those brothers are being exploited by the owners, by the schools. You know, I mean, just think about that. You know, and so it's okay to draw a football game, but just go a little bit further sometimes.
Then just how many yards
like
to the goal line and how far the pass was thrown and that kind of thing.
And the school administration say, just take the ball and run. The owner of the pro football team saying, shut up, take the ball and run. That's what I'm paying you for. And, you know, and some people say, okay, that's what I'll do. You know, it's so much going on in the world, it's kind of difficult for me to see how people get so engrossed in some things. You know, I mean, it's so much going on now. I mean, think, you know. This country is like something I feel is going to hell in the handbasket quick. It's a great experiment.
Right. Right.
Mm. All right. Thank you, brother. Appreciate your call. Thank you, Durham. Durham is in the house today. Thank you, Brother Adrian. Appreciate your call. Hey, now, the brother said, Dr. Bruce, Brother Adrian said it's a lifelong process of developing this awareness in terms of recapturing our African mind. And I think many of our people are afraid to be ourselves, right? And when we have what they call black talk, right, we're not against white people, right? We're not against anybody, but we're for ourselves. And the indoctrination and the degradation and the disrespect and the humiliation are all real, right? we're bleaching ourselves. We're killing ourselves, right? We're harming ourselves. We don't love ourselves. Those things are real, right? And after a while, you don't blame the puppet. You blame the puppet master for teaching the puppet how to be a puppet. All right. Brother George, any comments before we move on?
No, sir. I'm learning like a lot of the listeners.
All right.
Thank you for having
Brother George in the loop, y'all. Of course. That's fine. That's my resident scholar, y'all. All right. Let's go down to 5802. Again, thank you, Brother Adrian. We're going over to 5802. You're live. Do you have a question or comment? 5802. You there?
Good afternoon, Brother Marvin, Brother Bruce.
Good afternoon.
This is Herbie White in Durham, North Carolina.
Herbie, hey, Brother Herbie, how you doing?
I'm doing fine, thank you. If George Washington is the father of this country, then Turner is the father of Black America. When I was in New York and I visited some friends, my friend's daughter had to do an essay for school about what if somebody who had died a long time ago came back, what would they think? And she was trying to come up with somebody, and I told her to do Nat Turner. And she didn't know who it was, so I told her to go to the library. And so several weeks later, when I came back to visit again, I asked her, how did it turn out? She said, I wrote it about Nat Turner, but my teacher wouldn't allow me to read my essay. All the other kids could read read theirs, but I wasn't allowed to read mine.
Mm. And that was because of the nature of her topic.
So that goes back to what Brother Bruce said about what kind of pictures you have hanging in your house and what's on your mind.
Good point, Brother Herbert. Good point, Brother Herbert.
That's so true.
They didn't want that kind of information spread around to the rest of the class.
Exactly.
That's true. That's why we have to do the work of educating ourselves, right? We're going to have to put ourselves in the driver's seat, mentally, physically, emotionally, socially, culturally, right, to guide and drive our people right, to an effective way of living, right, and not mimicking other people, but standing strong for ourselves, deciding for ourselves, determining our future for ourselves, and we're going to have to do that. We're the only ones that can do that for ourselves. And again, like I stated earlier in the show, we are the only people in this country, the only group that have laws designed against us. The system is set against us. We're the only ones that have been enslaved. And so when other people come to the country, they're like, oh, why? Well, why can't they just do this? But we have a system that's in place with rules, laws, and regulations, right, that we have to try to continue to strive and fight for just to be acknowledged as human beings to start with. So we have to continue to do that work. Thank you, Brother Herbert. Any other comments before we move on?
No, I just want to say that if you don't have a recapture your African mind, that as a Black person, you would be afraid to say that you love Nat Turner.
Mm.
Okay, good comment, Brother Herbie.
That's true. Thank you, Brother Herbie. Appreciate your call. Durham is in the house today. All right, let's go on over to 2091. You're up next, and you're on the Empowerment Hour. Do you have a question or comment?
Yes, hello.
Dr. Bruce. Hey, welcome
yes,
to the show.
How you doing
yes,
today?
Sir.
Yes, this is Chris from Durham. How you doing,
hey,
Brother
Chris?
Marvin? And,
I'm good.
Dr. Bruce. Yeah, I just want to say, Dr. Bruce, he can give a lot of information in a little bit of time. He'll master at that. Appreciate that. And I just wanted, Brother Bruce, could you give us a little information on Negro land.
On Negro land?
Yes.
Now, what?
I think it was part of Africa, I think. I don't know if it's on today's map, but maybe on the older map.
Oh, yeah. They, as a matter of fact, they did name, and since you mentioned it too, Brother Chris, they did name certain parts of Africa Negro land, and not only that on many ancient maps, but also you make me think about the fact that there are several islands around the world that are called Negro Islands. And as a matter of fact, I was reading about one up near up near Newfoundland and Canada, up above Maine in that area. There's an island called Negro Island. There's also another island in the Philippines called Negro Island, and there's several others around the country. And since you mentioned, there are many black people who want to change the names of these Negro islands and Negro land and kind of things that you're talking about, though you were talking about an ancient map. They want to change those names, and some people are against that. And I can understand why they would want to change them, but when they begin to change those names, then the history will be lost. And if it's changed to something else that does not clearly state who the first inhabitants were or who the people were who occupied the land, whether they were first or whatever, that when that designation is taken away, then the history is lost, and upcoming generations will not know that that black people were ever there. As an example, not in terms of the name, but as an example, when you look and study the kings and queens of Europe, the Scottish and the Irish, and you begin to see these ancient King Edward and King James and the Prince of Wales and these other kings and queens, Anne Boleyn and Anne of Scots, when you find that these were people from the Stuart family who were actually black people whose identities were changed and taken advantage of, which is taken advantage and control of, which is another whole lecture I'm working on now. But when you find out that Queen Elizabeth is related to black people, today's queen related to black people in ancient Scotland many, many years ago, from the time of Fergus the Moor. But anyway, so when you begin to white people will begin to step into our history and take control of our knowledge and of our accomplishments if we allow them to begin to alter or change the names of places and things. Just to make it briefly, because I know you got some calls, Brother Martin, but that's another lecture. I want to thank Brother Chris for his call, though.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Brother Chris. I appreciate that. We got one left on the line now. One call left.
All?
But before we get there, yeah, that's all today, brother. But let's continue to move forward with this. Now, what you just said was the Scottish people and the British people and many of the European founding families have their roots in African Moors, many. And then you mentioned in your lecture that on this side, many of the indigenous peoples are people of color or African. And so at every turn, we're representing ourselves again, and we get to see ourselves as a part of the entire picture. Can you speak to that real quickly, Dr. Bruce, about how the relationship between the indigenous people that were here and the African first families in Europe?
That's another whole lecture, Brother Martin, but I will just quickly say this, that all of us did not come to America on slave ships, okay?
All right.
And not only America, but even in the islands of the Caribbean, even in islands like Montserrat, in the island of Barbados and Barbuda, and the island of Antigua and Jamaica, many of us went to those islands not necessarily on slave ships, but we went when black people were exiled out of the British Isles into the newfound colonies of America, and that's the way some of us came here. Not saying now that we didn't come on slave ships, because we know we did, but
Not all of us came here on slave ships. And also many of us, as we know, the indigenous people of all the lands of the earth were dark-skinned people. So black people were already here from the beginning, already here, not sent here by anybody from Scotland or Ireland, or not sent by a slave ship from Congo or from Ghana or Guinea, but were already here and had traveled here many, many thousands of years ago when we trekked and trotted across the whole of the 196,940,000 square miles that we call this planet. Black people inhabited this whole earth, you see, and not all of us came here on slave ships. So anyway, that's another lecture for another time, but I can tell you want to hear about that when I keep working on it, because I've got a lot of information on that stuff.
All right. Thank you. Let's go on over to 1471. You're up next and you're live. Welcome to the show.
Oh, good afternoon, brothers. I had just tuned in and I wasn't prepped yet, but good. How you doing?
That's brother. That's Dr. Rogers, isn't it?
Yeah. Hey,
yeah,
Dr. Rogers.
How
are you?
I'm wondering.
All right, brother. All right, Doc. I'm glad you tuned in today. You just got in, though, huh? You're a little late for class.
Okay, yep. But I heard you just explaining that story. That's good. That was excellent.
Which one is that now?
The one you were talking about, the native people, and really who that was, this native, and what that actually means to be native, and all of that. That was excellent.
Oh.
That was real good.
Oh, I'm glad you know, coming from you, I always appreciate you know, because you know when you give me an accolade, I figure you really mean it, and you know where you from, whence you coming, so you understand that. Yeah, that's
yeah.
Right.
We appreciate that. Thank you. But you're right. Yeah. We all did not come over on slave ships. We did not.
That's right. We did not. But you know, Doc, you and I have talked about it a long time, and we're gonna talk about it even more. I just don't understand, and I talked about it to a good friend of mine, Tim McIver. He's been doing a lot of reading on this stuff, too. Well, why do you think it is, and you know it is true, that Dr. Ben, Dr. Clark, and some of the historians, Van Sertima, some of the other ones, Chancellor Williams, and some of the others, white and black, never dealt a whole lot with this whole British Isles connection with us. Why do you think that is? Access to information,
you know,
I'm thinking.
You know, that's a powerful question. But there is a logical reason.
Uh-huh.
They were not able to get access to the material.
I think you're right. That's what I was.
Real major issue for a lot of our early scholars is that, you know, Harvard was not going to let no black man in that library to sitting up in there at 6 o'clock in the evening studying and going downstairs to the archives. That wasn't going to happen.
You're right about that. I'm glad. Yeah, because as I'm beginning to, I'm learning more now, but think than I ever have. But what I'm beginning to find out is that I keep questioning myself. I said, wait a minute, Ben and Clark. Now, Jay Rogers did talk some about it, but not in a whole lot of depth like we did when we discussing Kemet or when we were discussing the kingdoms of Ghana, Mali, and Songhai. And I think you're right. What it is now that computers are available, people can sit at home and read those books at Harvard from right in their own living rooms, in their own kitchen, or wherever they want to be.
Right. Yeah. If you remember, J.A. Rogers had to go to the Hispanic islands to get a lot of that material he wanted. He had to go to Cuba.
That's right. I forgot.
Yeah, he had to go to those kind of places to get those books.
But now with a good computer, you can pull it up and bring it right to you without even going anywhere, can't you?
Without it, just go on those databases. A lot of those databases, there's, you know, I know you're familiar with that major, humongous database called the Gutenberg database.
Oh, yeah, I am.
Now, you know how the Gutenberg came about. That came about from... what's his name that started
the press.
Museum?
That's
where that came from.
Mm-hmm.
So they had. It really boils down to the resources, because prior to, you know, all of these computers, the only thing you had was a microfiche. you go downstairs in the archive and take that little film-like thing and put it on a glass and slide it through this microfiche, and that was how you could read.
And most people weren't going to do all that, you know.
That's right. They couldn't. Mm-hmm. They couldn't do that. I mean, even North Carolina Central. Well, I was there. I had to go down and get the microfiche.
That's right. That's right.
I couldn't go into the database. I couldn't go get Nexus Lectures.
But now you can go into the art galleries of France and England and pull up those pictures on the walls through your computer and all kinds of things. Right, right. You don't have to
get those letters.
That's right. You don't. You don't have to get a ticket to go across the water and spend money and that kind of thing. Right. You're right. That's right.
Yes.
But anyway, it's just a lot, Brother Marvin. I know your time is running. We, Dr. Rogers and I, still talking to old people, learning and listening.
That's right.
And that is what it's all about. It's that African American empowerment. Yes, sir, Brother George.
Yeah. Dr. Bridges, I got a question for you. Because a lot of the information about our historical past sounds so unbelievable because of all the books that have been written to the contrary, what do you think it's going to take for our people to stop being afraid of even hearing, you know, who we are, what we've accomplished, the struggles of our people? What do you think it's going to take?
What we're doing now to begin to hear more and more of this kind of information from a lot of different sources and a lot of different people and places and reading. The more they begin to hear it, George, it's almost like the more you begin to, if you're not a swimmer and didn't grow up around water, that's the reason a person who grows up in the island is most times a better swimmer than you and more accustomed to the water and not in fear of the water. Many of us are in fear of even going to the beach, as we were talking about earlier, but it's because we're not used to it, and it's the same way with knowledge. If you get used to hearing knowledge and being around people and reading and going, like Dr. Rogers says, into the libraries, you'll get used to the water, and eventually you'll want to jump in and try to swim.
Okay.
And you won't be afraid. You won't be afraid of drowning.
Right.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, Brother George. Dr. Rogers is up next week, y'all. Join us next week. Final comments. I'll start with you, Dr. Rogers, and then Dr. Bruce, Brother George, and we'll wrap it up.
Okay.
I want to just, my comment, Brother Marvin, is be sure to tune in to area code 215-490-9832. Every Tuesday night at 8 o'clock. Doc will be back on, I think. Will you be on this week, Doc?
No, the next week.
Okay, week after next. Be sure to tune in, 215-490-9832. Dr. Rogers' Black Think Tank, the Black Reality Think Tank. Okay, that's me, brother.
Right.
You know what, Dr. Williams, I apologize. I will be back on. I've got a sister that is coming on, who was a part of the African Revolutionary Army, and her husband, and they were caught up in that stuff, and so she's going to come on and talk about her experience.
I'll be sure to tune in. So to those who are tuned in, 215-490-9832, Tuesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Black Rob to think.
I'm glad you reminded that, because I would have forgotten that. Thank you. Thank you so
much. That's why we got to work together, Doc.
Yep.
That's right.
That's it.
All right. Dr. Rogers. Dr. Rogers will be with us next week as we continue to do our series on Dr. Whitson and the foundation for how he has created so much for us. So we're going to work with that next week. Tell a friend. Join us. Brother George, final comments.
So, sir, I'm good, brother. I learned a lot, and I really appreciate the two doctors, you know, doing what they do for us. Thank you, brother.
Thank you, brother. Now, we all family. This is empowerment. It's education, right? And I want those listeners who are new to think about this. We're not against white people, right? It's like, oh, it's black. We are educating ourselves for the future. We have to get out of the indoctrination and into recapturing our mind. The only way you're going to do it is to educate yourself and your children. We must do the work of working on ourselves. Until next week, brothers and sisters, stay strong, stay positive, stay motivated, stay empowered, and pursue with all your might your African mind. You deserve to be who you were born to be. Nothing more, nothing less, but you're the greatest God ever created. Peace and blessings.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Thanks, Dr. Bruce. Peace.